Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. Today's Thursday, June 16th. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, complete with a photo of Governor Reynolds signing a document, the title, Iowa Becomes Last State to Criminalize Elder Abuse. With strokes of several pens, Wednesday, Iowa became the last state in the nation to criminalize elder abuse. Governor Kim Reynolds signed into law Senate File 522, which sets criminal charges ranging from misdemeanors to felonies, punishable by up to 25 years in prison based on the severity of the crime, for abusing, assaulting, or financially exploiting a person age 60 or older. Reynolds signed the bill during a ceremony at Highland Ridge Senior Living Community in Williamsburg. After years of advocates pressing for action, the bill passed unanimously in both legislative chambers in the 2022 session. The safety and well-being of older Iowans is so very important, and this bill provides greater reassurance that there will be consequences for those who target and harm them, Reynolds said. Iowa families and seniors deserve to know that we will not stand for any type of elder abuse or exploitation in our state. At least 1 in 10 Americans age 60 and older experience elder abuse each year nationwide, according to FBI data and the National Council on Aging. Previously, Iowa was the only state in the nation where elder abuse was not a crime. Iowa law currently includes definitions of elder abuse, but does not include criminal penalties. Because it has not been a crime in Iowa, accurate data about the prevalence of elder abuse in the state is hard to ascertain. However, Iowa has seen a sharp increase in reports of abuse or neglect of dependent adults age 18 or older, including older Iowans. The Iowa Department of Human Services, which does not keep its own statistics on elder abuse, noted a nearly 26% increase in dependent adult abuse reports from 2020 to 2021, with more than 10,900 reported cases of alleged abuse or neglect. However, more than half of those reports were rejected by the department because they did not fit within the existing legal definition that mandates the victim be classified as a dependent adult and the perpetrator be an official caretaker, according to the department's semi-annual Department Adult Statistical Reports. A total of more than 8,600 cases were reported in 2020, more than 3,950 of which were rejected. Just from July to December of last year, 5,800 dependent adult abuse cases were reported to Human Services, a 25% increase compared with 2019. Of those, more than half of the reported cases were rejected. The bill signed by Reynolds would fix that gap and better protect all older Iowans from abuse, according to AARP Iowa. AARP Iowa has advocated for elder abuse legislation for several years, and we know this new law will be an important tool for helping put a stop to existing abuse and hopefully preventing it in the future, advocacy manager Anthony Carroll said. About 17.5% of Iowa's population is 65 or older, and an estimated approximately 66,000 Iowans are living with Alzheimer's as of 2020, up from 64,000 in 2018. That's according to the Iowa Department of Public Health. That number is projected by the Alzheimer's Association to grow to 73,000 by 2025. State Senator Kevin Kinney from Oxford, a Democrat, said the new law will give Iowa law enforcement and financial institutions better tools to stop and prevent elder abuse. Kinney is a member of the Iowa Senate Judiciary Committee and a former deputy county sheriff who handled elder abuse cases in Johnson County. Making those who abuse our elders criminally liable will better protect older Iowans, Kinney said in a statement. As a deputy sheriff, I helped investigate several cases of elder abuse. Sometimes the punishments under Iowa law fell seriously short of both providing justice for the victim and deterring future crimes. I'm glad to have helped take this bipartisan step forward. Advocates say elder abuse often is hidden and involves financial theft in some way, but also can include physical, emotional, or sexual abuse. Elder abuse can be committed by strangers, but is more likely to involve family members or other people trusted by the victim, according to AARP Iowa. The new law, which takes effect July 1, will enhance criminal penalties for second and subsequent assaults against older individuals and requires mandatory minimum sentences, increases penalties for thefts from older Iowans, adds an additional civil penalty for consumer fraud committed against a person who is 60 or older, and creates a new crime of elder abuse that includes physical and emotional abuse, neglect, isolation, or sexual exploitation against a person 60 years of age or older who is unable to protect himself or herself from elder abuse as a result of mental or physical condition, or because of a personal circumstance which results in an increased risk of harm to the person. Reynolds also signed a proclamation Wednesday declaring this week as World Elder Abuse Awareness Week in Iowa. "Now the work begins," said Bob Welsh of Coralville, a member of the Older Iowans Legislature, who has long pushed for the change in the law. "We need to educate people on the law." Also on the front page, this by Marissa Payne, state speeds up Wright Brothers Boulevard interchange project. The Iowa DOT this week accelerated plans to reconfigure an interchange at Interstate 380 and Wright Brothers Boulevard Southwest, giving a major boost to a fast-growing part of town that has become host to massive industrial developments. As a federal cash influx has added support for infrastructure projects nationwide, the interchange reconfiguration was added to the Iowa DOT's five-year plan, spanning the 2023-27 budget years, a first step to securing all the funding. "We are extremely pleased that this particular interchange really is going to be built in record time," City Manager Jeff Pomerantz said. "It's an incredible combination of housing as well as businesses and our airport, and this is a very important strategic area as far as job creation in Cedar Rapids. We look forward to seeing this project begin." Kathy Cutler, a transportation planner with the Iowa DOT, said the interchange will essentially stretch from 6th Street to Earhart Lane Southwest and from just shy of the Highway 30 interchange to the Swisher-Shoeyville interchange at 120th Street in Johnson County. Cedar Rapids wants to rebuild a portion of Wright Brothers Boulevard Southwest further east and will develop and design that, Cutler said. The projects connect so one contractor can simultaneously build and coordinate them. Pomerantz said the two-lane bridge at Wright Brothers Boulevard Southwest is nowhere near the capacity needed to serve businesses and residents, so the state support is key to meeting that demand. City engineer Brenna Fall told the Gazette the city's project will focus on safety and capacity improvements along the Wright Brothers Boulevard Southwest corridor between 6th Street Southwest and Earhart Lane. The city will engage a consultant for design of the city's project, while the DOT's project is in the works. There's no cost estimate and design yet. Overall, the Iowa DOT's entire I-380 widening project, including the Wright Brothers Boulevard Southwest exchange, totals $99.5 million. The lion's share of that, $86.5 million, is grading and paving. Currently, the I-380 Wright Brothers Boulevard interchange is a diamond interchange where a highway crosses a minor road. The recreation or reconfiguration would create a diverging diamond interchange, where Cutler said the traffic crosses like an X in the middle of the bridges. This eliminates the need for left-turning vehicles to cross the paths of approaching vehicles, which Cutler said more quickly moves a volume of traffic higher that wants to go left. Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell told the Iowa Transportation Commission the interchange is a vital part of the freight and transportation system located at the center of an industry hub. "This interchange provides access to the rapidly growing area that includes our airport and associated freight, shipping, warehousing, logistics, ethanol, industrial development, and existing and future housing developments. Over the last decade, and especially the last 6 years, O'Donnell said, new development in Cedar Rapids has accelerated as interstate commerce businesses have invested more than $1 billion south of Highway 30. These developments have created more than 1,000 new jobs and retained at least 2,200 existing jobs. Additional housing developments will continue to add traffic in the area. Cedar Rapids is seeing an uptick in larger warehouse and distribution facilities looking to leverage the proximity to the airport, interstate, and rail network, and existing large industrial companies are expanding, O'Donnell said. Slated to open this year are a $108.6 million FedEx Ground Distribution Center on Commerce Park Drive Southwest and a classified defense aerospace facility worth more than $170 million from multinational aerospace company BAE Systems. Over the next 1 to 3 years, the city is planning for $23 million in new construction in this growth area. Planned infrastructure projects there total more than $28 million. For all the activity in the area, there is an antiquated egress at the interchange and a tremendous bottleneck, O'Donnell said. According to Iowa DOT data last updated in 2019, the traffic count at the interchange to the west is about 14,000, though most cars peel off at 6th Street southwest. The count east of the interchange is about 7,000. Given the sheer volume of projects in the works, City Economic Development Manager Caleb Mason said a comprehensive traffic study of the area south of Highway 30 was the impetus for the city seeking state assistance. There will be hundreds of new employees between the new developments, Mason said, plus the movement of freight in and out of the FedEx facility will total about 3,000 to 4,000 trips a day. Chris DeWolf, the Lil Drugstore Products president and chief executive officer, said the interchange reconfiguration is critical right now, both for economic development and for safety. He said he sees employees leave every day at a standstill amid the traffic at the interchange, as well as people charging across the interchange on foot, dodging trucks and other vehicles. There's so much going on out there, DeWolf said, of the southwest quadrant, whether it's the several 10,000 square feet of industrial expansion that has occurred, whether it is the continued development of the school systems out there, both Kirkwood as well as College Community, as well as the additional housing that's occurring. The Iowa DOT will hold a public information meeting from 5 to 6 p.m. June 21st at its District 6 office. The meeting will discuss the proposed widening of I-380 and rebuilding the Wright Brothers interchange. The Iowa DOT recently completed the first of three phases of work to reconstruct a segment of the high-volume Collins Road corridor, improving traffic flow and stormwater management, and adding pedestrian facilities around Lindale Mall and First Avenue E. The next segment is around the Collins Aerospace Campus on C Avenue Northeast to the Lindale Mall commercial area, estimated at $40 million. O'Donnell said Cedar Rapids is ready to begin the preliminary engineering and design phase, and state assistance would support right-of-way acquisition and construction. The third and final phase is estimated to cost $25 million. Turning to the Iowa Today page, on page 2, this story by Grace King. The Iowa City School Board unanimously agreed to purchase a building for $8.7 million that will serve as a space for professional development for educators, the online learning program, and possibly career and technical education. The district is buying the building, known as the Tyler Building, at 301 ACT Drive in Iowa City. The building they are buying from ACT with physical plant and equipment levy funds. The property tax levy can be used to maintain school buildings, complete site improvements, and buy school equipment. We see this as long-term serving our students, Superintendent Matt Digner said. It serves a lot of different needs to us. We can definitely use the space. If we have this, it opens up a lot of opportunities for what we can provide students. Board member J.P. Clausen was not present at the meeting Tuesday. ACT is a nonprofit that provides college and career assessment tests to students. The Tyler Building was built in the 1980s. ACT recently invested $7 million in a new roof, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning improvements, lighting upgrades, and a new fire alarm system. The 85,000 finished square foot building sits on 7.9 acres. Dwayne Van Hemmert, consultant on the school district's facilities plan, said he expects the district to be able to get another 50 years of use from the building, even though an appraiser said the life expectancy of the building was 25 years. Van Hemmert estimated it would cost more than $22 million to buy land and build a building of its size today. ACT also is leaving behind an estimated $2 million worth of first-class furniture, Van Hemmert said. He estimates the cost of utilities for the building to be about $7,000 a month, similar to what the district pays for the administration building at 1725 North Dodge Street. Buying the building is part of the school district's facilities master plan, which called for the purchase of a building to act as a multi-use facility by this summer. ACT has a long history of being a good community partner in Iowa City, and this arrangement is one more way for us to remain connected to our community, said Janet Godwin, ACT CEO and former Iowa City School Board member. After the pandemic, many of our team members opted to stay connected and work off campus in remote or hybrid schedules, so we determined that we could consolidate and make better use of the space on our campus, Godwin said in a news release. Working with the school district on this property transfer is a win-win-win for ACT, the district, and our community. The district will take occupancy of the building July 5, several weeks before the purchase agreement closes, to prepare the space for the 2022-23 school year. The Tyler Building will be home to ICCSD Online, a virtual learning school the district launched during the 2021-22 school year, serving about 850 students. Educators have been using a building known as Old Hoover as office space and a place to meet with the online students in person if necessary. Old Hoover, however, was demolished to create more parking and tennis courts at City High School. Degner said there also is no space for educators to meet in a large group without disrupting the school day. The new building offers space for that. School board members Jane Finch and Macca Pilcher noted the assessed value of the property is half its purchase price. Assessed values often are lower than market values. The market has never been so low for office space, Finch said. People aren't buying office space. School Board President Sean Eystone said many properties the district previously looked at cost more for less space than the Tyler Building. We've been looking at sites all over town to do this type of work, and it's so exciting that we landed on the Tyler Building, School Board member Lisa Williams said. I think it's easy to say it's light years ahead of anything else we've been looking at. School board member Ruthina Malone said it does not feel like the district has invested as much into its online program as it should. She's looking forward to seeing it have a dedicated home with this building purchase. We're a public education district that every time we build something, it tends to fill up pretty darn quickly, Malone said. You don't get a building for that price, for that size. Also on the Today page, assistant principal reassigned after student vandalism. This story by Aaron Jordan. A City High administrator whose students and parents said opened a school door for a senior prank that turned into vandalism has resigned from that job and now will teach at Iowa City West High School. Scott Jesperson shared his intent to step away from his assistant principal position at City High School. Principal John Bacon wrote in an email to parents Wednesday. The Iowa City Community School District Board of Directors accepted Jesperson's resignation Tuesday night. City High parents told the Gazette last month Jesperson let some students into the building late May 22nd to hang balloons and streamers, But other students came in and damaged the building by spray painting walls, pouring syrup on items, and cutting up photos, among other actions. The school district would not comment to the Gazette, saying it was a personnel matter. Spokeswoman Kristen Pedersen would not answer questions about the vandalism, including the damage estimate, why the school did not file a police complaint, and if there will be repercussions for the students involved. The Gazette tried to reach Jesperson on May 26th at the school, but he wasn't there, and sent him a message on Facebook that he did not respond to. Damage to the school was discovered early May 23rd, according to a call for service to Iowa City Police. The call at 3:59 a.m. said there were several subjects in the parking lot, some laying down. When police arrived, they met with school employees, who told them they had not approached the 20 or so people in the parking lot and that officials were trying to assess the damage to the property. More than 630 people have signed an online petition supporting Jesperson, who parents and students said was placed on leave following the incident. On the night of Sunday, May 22, the City High senior class did their senior prank. Graduating senior Savannah Steele wrote on the petition, "This rapidly went downhill due to some students destroying school property and trashing the school rather than doing the original prank. Mr. Jesperson is a person who has always showed kindness. His generosity was wrongfully taken advantage of this night, resulting with consequences on himself. We want to show the ICCSD how much Mr. Jesperson means to City High." A GoFundMe campaign organized by Tyson Friday, a City High parent, has raised $2,900 to go towards repairing damage to the school. Bacon's email said Jesperson will move to a teaching position at West High in the fall. Phil Hansen, who has been athletic director at City for 3 years, will become assistant principal. Jerry Coleman will shift from being dean of students to assistant principal, the email says. We turn now to the Insight page, and the guest editorial today is a reprint from the Philadelphia Inquirer on Wednesday, and the title, Cheney's Lonely Fight. It shouldn't make headlines when a member of Congress upholds their sworn oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Representative Liz Cheney, Republican from Wyoming, stands out as one of the few elected Republicans in Washington willing to put country before party. The vice chair of the House Select Committee investigating the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol understands that the peaceful transfer of power is a linchpin of our democracy. She also fully grasps the historic importance of ensuring accountability for the months-long effort by Donald Trump and his minions to steal the 2020 presidential election. During the hearings last week and on Monday, Cheney plowed ahead to follow the facts, speak truth to power, and shine a light on Trump's seditious actions. Cheney used clear language and the video testimony of Trump officials and his own family to show the former president knew the election was not stolen but continued to press the big lie. Cheney's patriotic focus on Trump's attempted coup has come at great professional and personal cost, including death threats. The daughter of former Vice President Dick Cheney had been a rising star in the Republican Party, but she could lose her seat to a Trump-backed challenger in the Wyoming primary August 16th. Polls show Cheney trailing Harriet Hageman by as much as 30 points. Hageman, who once called Trump racist and xenophobic, now said, "He was the greatest president of my lifetime." The Inquirer editorial board does not typically agree with Cheney's policy positions, but we agree that Trump is a danger to democracy, which is why we're taking the unusual step of endorsing Cheney in the upcoming congressional primary. While most of our readers can't vote for Cheney, they can donate to her campaign, send a message of support, encourage friends in her district to vote for her, and talk with friends and family about the ongoing threat to democracy. Friday will mark the 50th anniversary of the Watergate break-in, which led to President Richard Nixon's resignation. Nixon's abuse of power and obstruction of justice were also a threat to democracy and the rule of law, but Republicans in Congress placed the Constitution and country above politics. Cheney's lonely fight for her fellow Republican support suggests Congress cannot be counted on this time. And again, that's a reprint from Philadelphia. Todd Dorman's 24-hour Dorman column today is titled Iowa GOP Followed Trump's Lead. So Donald Trump didn't listen to rational people in his inner circle telling him allegations of widespread election fraud pushed by his sketchiest advisors were baloney. Surprised? But the January 6th Congressional Committee's methodical account of Trump's decision to shun the truth provides clarity. Trump ignored the facts and pushed reckless lies about a stolen election, leading his supporters to attack the Capitol. One of the clear lessons of January 6th is if you keep telling Americans our election system lacks integrity and is rife with fraud, bad things happen. Undermining democratic institutions for political profit carries costly consequences. It could even lead to violence. Like Trump, Republicans who run the Iowa legislature also ignored that lesson. In 2020, Iowa saw record turnout in the June primary, thanks to the Iowa Secretary of State sending absentee ballot request forms to every voter amid a pandemic. Days later, the GOP legislature banned the practice without permission from lawmakers. Why? Voter integrity, we were told. The false subtext is absentee voting can't be trusted. The Trump campaign sued Linn County Auditor Joel Miller for sending voters filled-in request forms. Trump disdains early voting. But then Trump lost the election and big lies followed. The Capitol was attacked in an effort to stop certification of Joe Biden's win. It was a dark day and begged the question. Have Republican efforts to cast doubts on our elections and democracy gone too far? Yeah. But instead of reflecting on what the GOP hath wrought, Iowa Republican lawmakers doubled down. They talked about how voters still feel our election system is flawed, feelings obviously spawned by fakery. They say we need more limits on voting to make people who believe Trump's lies feel better. So they passed more voting restrictions, shrinking the window for early voting, shortening voting hours, tossing out any absentee ballots that don't arrive at auditor's office by 8 p.m. on election night, limiting who can drop off absentee ballots on behalf of a voter, limiting ballot drop boxes to one per county, throwing up barriers to satellite voting, and leveling potential criminal penalties at rogue auditors. At best, Republicans took advantage of Trump's fog of lies as cover to further restrict voting in ways that could give them an advantage. At worst, as State Senator Jim Carlin suggested, most of his GOP Senate colleagues believed stolen election nonsense. Either way, the same Trump lies that fueled an attack on the Capitol also provided a political pretext for voting restriction in Iowa. Last October, top Iowa Republicans stood with Trump as he repeated his election lies at an Iowa rally. They've embraced his endorsement. This month, Republicans crowed that Iowa's primaries drew the second highest turnout in 12 years, but turnout fell well below 2020 amid voting restrictions. In larger counties, according to the Iowa Capitol Dispatch, hundreds of absentee ballot requests were rejected for missing the now revised deadline. Trump damaged our democracy. Iowa Republicans followed his lead. Worst of all, the attack continues. And that is 24-Hour Dorman. One community letter today, and the title is Flat Tax a Victory Only for Wealthy. Regarding the recent guest column praising Iowa's new income flat tax, the economic trickle-down theory premise is false. In addition, it ignores the ramifications of reduced tax revenues. Republicans keep arguing if we reduce income taxes, more business will invest in Iowa and generate more jobs, etc. Time and again, this Reaganomics fails. Competitive state and local tax breaks reduce tax revenue even further to minimum levels, while the new businesses suck up energy and environmental resources and provide low-wage jobs. This does not benefit family wage earners or grow our economy. Just look at the results Kansas got when it tried this. Despite a state budget surplus, Republican legislators underfunded Iowa's public schools, which used to be a draw for industries seeking educated workers and a drawing card to bring new employees here. Republican legislators underfunded Iowa's universities, which used to draw industries and research grants as well as attract out-of-state students. Republican legislators underfunded state parks and natural resources, which used to actually improve Iowans' quality of life. Right-wing politicians and special interests hope by promoting a flat tax, voters will rejoice in the bone that their minimal tax savings brings while ignoring the consequences of reduced revenue and the steak dinner that those tax reduction proponents dine on. That letter is signed by Ann Solomon of Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, June 16, on IRIS. We turn now to the obituary page, and starting with the short notices, from Brandon, Esther C. Little, age 99, died Wednesday, June 15. Phillips Funeral Home, Vinton, is in charge. From Cedar Rapids, Stephen Ray Barber, age 67, died Wednesday, June 15. Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. Also in Cedar Rapids, Thomas D. Schumacher, age 78, died Wednesday, June 15. Phillips Funeral Home, Vinton, is in charge. In Decorah, Jean Ann Graben died Saturday, June 11. Helms Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. In Independence, Tammy L. Corbin, age 50, died Monday, June 13. The Reef Family Center is in charge of arrangements. From Tiffin, John Kafer, age 54, died Tuesday, June 14. Lansing Funeral Home and Cremation Service is in charge. And from Tipton, Alvin Lee Draper, age 74, died Wednesday, June 15. Fry Funeral Home in Tipton is in charge of arrangements. Turning now to the regular notices, first from Lone Tree, David, known as Dave Robert Ibsen, age 84, passed away June 14 at Mercy Hospital. Visitation will be Monday, June 20th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Lansing Funeral and Cremation Service, 605 Kirkwood Avenue, Iowa City, where the rosary will be recited at 5 p.m. Mass of Christian burial will be celebrated at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, June 21st at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Hills. Burial with military honors will follow at State St. Stanislaus Cemetery. Memorials may be directed to the family of David Ibsen. From Anamosa, Catherine Marie Close Oltmans, age 76, passed away Tuesday, June 14. A private family interment will be held at a later date at Riverside Cemetery, Anamosa. Iowa Cremation is in charge of arrangements. In Iowa City, Gary J. Hotka, age 66, lifelong resident and farmer, died surrounded by his family Tuesday, June 14. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, June 20 at St. Wenceslaus Catholic Church in Iowa City. Burial will follow at St. Joseph Cemetery. Visitation will be 4 to 7 p.m. Sunday at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service, where a parish rosary will be shared at 7 p.m. A complete obituary will appear in Friday's edition. To share a thought, memory, or condolence, visit the Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service website. From Sigourney, Virginia, known as Ginny Stroman, age 82, died Tuesday, June 14th at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids. Memorial Mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, June 18th at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Sigourney, with the Reverend Robert Lathrop officiating. Burial will be at Pleasant Grove Cemetery in Sigourney. Visitation is from 4:30 to 6:30 Friday, June 17th at Powell Funeral Home, where there will be a vigil service at 4:15. A memorial fund has been established for St. Mary's Catholic Church or the Keokuk County Hospice Foundation. Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Sigourney is caring for Ginny and her family. And from Solon, Paul, known as P.J. Smith, age 33, passed away Sunday, June 12th. A public visitation will be held on Saturday, June 18th, from 10 a.m. to noon at the Marian Methodist Church. A memorial service will follow at 12:30 p.m. Memorial donations may be made in P.J.'s honor to the GuideLink Center in Iowa City or the Linn County Mental Health Access Center. Cedar Memorial is handling arrangements for the family. Turning now to the sports page, Wounded Wolves still ranked. This high school baseball notebook story by K.J. Pilcher. They have nicknamed themselves the Wounded Wolves. The modified moniker fits Marian well. The defending Class 3A state champions have endured injuries, illness, and inconveniences, but they are still 11-5 after a doubleheader split with Williamsburg on Monday. The Wolves are ninth in the current Iowa High School Baseball Coaches Association ranking, entering today's WOMAC Conference doubleheader at 2A No. 5 Dyersville Beckman. "We keep adding stuff," Marian coach Steve Fish said with a laugh when he mentioned the team has added homeless and sick to the wounded adjective. "We've had all these things that we've dealt with. We still have high aspirations. It's just been very difficult for a lot of different reasons. One of the inconveniences is the lack of a true home field. Renovations to the Marian baseball field surface haven't gone as planned, and it wasn't ready for this season. The Wolves have had to practice at Prospect Meadows and play home games at Mount Mercy's Plaster Athletic Complex. It has limited time to work with players as a team and individually. It just goes on," Fish said. "It's been one of those things. I don't expect anyone to feel sorry for us, though. Injuries have plagued many of the players. Jack Turka has missed most of the season. Sophomore outfielder Trey Frank has played in less than half the games. All-state pitcher Bodie Ray has only 2 mound appearances due to injury, posting a 1-0 mark. All-stater Miles Davis and Jackson Tejeda have missed games, and a handful of others have played through aches and bruises. Add in the fact catcher Caden Fromelt missed action due to food poisoning against Benton Community when the team was already shorthanded, and it seems like Murphy's Law has ruled at times. Adversity usually makes you stronger," Fish said. "We did have a good practice Wednesday, I feel. The one silver lining is the playing time young players are receiving." Fish has been able to get a look at the talent in the wings and get a glimpse of the future. Many have taken full advantage of the opportunity. "We still try to have a little fun," Fish said. "Young guys are stepping in, and they're getting experience." Independence has won 7 of its last 9 games. The 3A 8th-ranked Mustangs toppled No. 3 Cedar Rapids Xavier 14-6 Tuesday at home, improving their record to 14-6 overall. They are 11-3 in the WOMAC Conference. Offense has been a key to success. The Mustangs have scored double-digit runs 6 times, averaging 6.2 per game. They scored 16 twice and 14 3 times. Independence has a total of 117 hits, including 39 extra base hits with 25 doubles and 7 home runs. According to Varsity Bound Statistics, Solon sophomore Gehrig Turner leads the state in being hit by pitches. He's been plunked a whopping 18 times in 22 games. He has been hit 3 more times than Martinsdale St. Mary's Logan Wearmouth, who is second. And in some coaching news, this by Jeff Linder, Mayer out as coach, in as IC West AD. One of B.J. Mayer's first duties as Iowa City West athletics director will be to find his successor as girls basketball coach. Mayer's hiring as AD was approved by the Iowa City Community School Board Tuesday, effective July 1. "I'm excited about the opportunity to lead a whole athletics program," Mayer said. "Things have been pretty good at West, a lot of positives, and I want to keep that going. I have enough relationships, and I want to tweak some things that will keep West near the top." Mayer, age 50 and a native of Osage, will succeed Craig Hugel, who accepted the AD position at Benton Community. The promotion means the end, at least for now, of an extremely successful 15-year run as West girls basketball coach. Mayer compiled a 258-92 mark in Iowa City, winning state championships in 2012 and 2018. He coached numerous All-State players, including Allie Disterhoff, Miss Iowa Basketball 2013, and was selected as the Gazette's Girls Basketball Coach of the Decade in the 2010s. Mayer has two sons at Iowa City Liberty. Luke will be a senior next year, Braden a sophomore. "We've had numerous conversations about it, and their opinion mattered to me," Mayer said. "West has always been home for me." In another coaching story, Barnard elevated to head coach at Iowa City High. Okay, in terms of head-turning girls basketball news value, this ranks number 3 on a Wild Wednesday in June. And yet, quote, "I couldn't be more excited. This feels surreal, to be honest. I'm speechless," end quote, Lindsay Barnard said in the wake of her hiring as head girls basketball coach at Iowa City High. Barnard, age 34, served as lieutenant to Bill McTaggart in recent seasons. McTaggart resigned May 16th after a 23-year run that featured 402-129 record and a state championship in 2008. "Bill set me up for this," Barnard said. "He has given me a chance to learn. I've done every role within this program that exists, and I'm ready for this opportunity." A native of Pekin, Illinois, Barnard played at Monmouth College, then was an assistant coach at Loras College before moving to Iowa City. She is a science teacher at City High. Under Lindsley's leadership, City High is certain to build on its success, athletic director Philip Hansen said in a release. Her passion for basketball and her ability to make meaningful connections with her student athletes will allow City High girls basketball to continue to thrive. City High finished 19-5 last season and returns 2 starters for this next season. "Kelsey is one of the best players in the state," Barnard said, speaking of Kelsey Jones, an Iowa State University commit. "We have a lot of scoring talent back, and I really want us to clamp down defensively. I don't think the shot clock is going to affect us much." Turning now to the hoopla section, I'll read an abbreviated story, "Free Shakespeare in the Park," this by Diana Nolan. Every now and then, an actor might get to play a favorite role twice. Seldom does an actor get to play a character progressing in age or stature in separate shows. Katie Hahn, age 34, of Atkins, gets to do just that, with one big twist in 2019, followed by another big twist this week. She played the roguish Princess Hal in Riverside Theater's pre-pandemic production of Henry IV, Part 1, and is furthering her journey with the title role of King Henry V, performing as a man. One of Shakespeare's history plays, Henry V, opens Friday and continues through July 3 on the outdoor festival stage in Iowa City's Lower City Park. Admission is free for everyone. If you go, Riverside Theater presents Henry V at the outdoor festival stage June 17th through July 3. Showtime is 7:30 p.m., except for 6:30 p.m. July 2nd, so the audience members can see the city's holiday fireworks display. And again, admission is free. Audiences are invited to bring picnics or buy street food, snacks, and beverages at the theater's concession stand and see The Green Show at 7 p.m. featuring Elijah Jones. You can find more details at riversidetheater.org. In another abbreviated story, Tacos After Midnight, this by Elijah Desius. As the taco scene in Cedar Rapids continues to sizzle, SKO Tavern and Tacos is offering a new spot with a small menu downtown. The new offering, opened May 5 by Epic Catering, formerly known as the Nanke Restaurant Group, brings an eclectic bar atmosphere, late-night food offerings, and games to the space formerly occupied by the De La Vida Wine Bar. With one simple instruction, make it cool, a longtime bartender for Bell's Basics is taking his first plunge into food in a small but specialized menu. After Bell's announced plans to close earlier this year, Damian Papagni, 45, bartender for 8 years and manager for the past five, asked for some shifts at other bars. Instead, he was given charge of the new taco tavern, which will be adopting some novel features. In a move that helps SKO stand out from dozens of Mexican restaurants and bars in Cedar Rapids, the kitchen is open until 1:30 a.m., even later than Taco Bell. If you go, again, it's SKO Tavern and Tacos, 203 First Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. The hours are 4 p.m. to 2 a.m., Wednesday to Saturday. The kitchen is open to 1:30 a.m. Full menu served until midnight. Tacos only after midnight to 1:30. Carryout is not available. You can phone them at 319-200-5446. Also in the food category, Italian beef vendor opens in Nubo. Nubo City Market has welcomed several new businesses to its incubator. One of its newest additions, Capo Italian Beef, opened earlier this month. Capo owner Eli Herica offers Chicago-style Italian beef sandwiches, rice bowls, hot dogs, and more. Two other businesses are anticipated to open at the market later this month, bringing it to near full capacity. The summertime is always an exciting time of year at the market, Executive Director Julie Parisi said. We often see new businesses open up at this time after a long time of winter business planning. The foot traffic from many popular market and community events help start these new businesses on the right foot as they're gaining exposure for their business and meeting customers for the first time. An Iowa City-based hummus company is finding new momentum with an expansion to eastern Nebraska. Oasis Street Food, known for its preservative-free hummus, first expanded to store shelves with one Costco in Iowa. Now, Oasis is present in three Iowa Costcos and Nebraska Costcos where hummus lovers can find the product as far west as Lincoln. Although the company already had product at Omaha Hy-Vees and Natural Grocers, the expansion will be a big step in volume. Our hummus has proved to be popular in both metro areas and college communities, so these locations are ideal for us, co-founder Naftali Stamer said. Stramer and co-founder Ofer Sivan started Oasis Street Food in 2004 after they couldn't locally find the Mediterranean food they craved. With family recipes, they sold hummus and falafel from a food cart in Iowa City. They later opened a brick-and-mortar location on Iowa City's north side. Over time, they worked with the University of Nebraska-Lincoln Food Processing Center, which provided assistance with ingredients and shelf life, and invaluable help before they opened a second Oasis Falafel in Omaha in 2018. We attribute our growth to our fans who are known for asking for our products at stores across the Midwest, Sivan said. It really shows that people want to eat more healthy foods. As the desire for local, vegan, vegetarian, preservative-free, gluten-free, dairy-free, and high-protein superfoods grows, our hummus fits the bill. And in Iowa City, a new cocktail and tapas bar with a chic interior and sidewalk patio has opened at 121 East College Street. The Stuffed Olive, centered on the Martini Experience, opened May 19. From your favorite classic to new and exciting blends you've never seen before, you're sure to find a cocktail to love on our vast martini venue, the restaurant promises. In addition to an extensive martini menu, it offers hot and cold tapas, flatbreads, and weekend brunch service. The new restaurant is another brand from Paramount Bar Company, which owns the Roxy and Tap Tap in Iowa City. This is the third location of the Stuffed Olive opened by the company after Cedar Falls and Des Moines. Turning now to the Business 380 page, this story from the Gazette, Coralville-based West Music will acquire 119-year-old Griggs Music in Davenport, effective July 1, the company said in a joint news release. After an incredible 47-year career with Griggs Music, it's time to move on to a new chapter of my life. It has been my honor and privilege to have spent my entire career with one company and to have been CEO for the past 24 years, Steve Judge, Griggs Music CEO and co-owner, said in the release. Financial terms of the deal were not disclosed. The Griggs brand eventually will transition to West Music. Robin Walenta, West Music CEO, told the Gazette, both Quad Cities locations will continue to operate, Griggs in Davenport and the West Music venue in Moline. Both companies service area schools. Griggs was started in 1903. Its Center Point Road Northeast store in Cedar Rapids closed about a year ago, Walenta said. West Music was established in 1941 and is family-owned. It has locations in eastern Iowa and western Illinois. And this AP story on the Business 380 page, so long, Internet Explorer. The browser retired on Wednesday. Internet Explorer is finally headed to pasture. As of Wednesday, Microsoft no longer will support the once dominant browser that legions of web servers love to hate and a few still claim to adore. The 27-year-old application now joins BlackBerry phones, dial-up modems, and Palm Pilots in the dustbin of tech history. IE's demise was not a surprise. A year ago, Microsoft said that it was putting an end to Internet Explorer on June 15, pushing users to its Edge browser, which was launched in 2015. The company made clear then it was time to move on. Not only is Microsoft Edge a faster, more secure, and more modern browsing experience than Internet Explorer, but it is also able to address a key concern: compatibility for older legacy websites and application, said Sean Landersey, General Manager of Microsoft Edge Enterprise. Users marked Explorer's passing on Twitter, with some referring to it as bug-ridden and insecure, or the top browser for installing other browsers. For others, it was a moment for 1990s nostalgia memes, while the Wall Street Journal quoted a 22-year-old who was sad to see IE go. Finishing up with the Cedar Rapids and Iowa City weather page, we are looking for mostly sunny skies today and tomorrow, with highs in the upper 80s and lows around 62 to 59. Normally, our high today is 81 and our low is 60. The record high of 99 degrees was set in 1918. The record low of 47 was set in 1947. We're in the full moon phase, with moon rise at 11:31 p.m. and moon set at 8:50 a.m. Sunset tonight is at 8:44 p.m., sunrise tomorrow at 5:31, giving us 15 hours and 13 minutes of daylight. We're approaching that longest day of the year. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, June 16th. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening and have a great, safe day. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.